It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Okay. I'd always do it this way because it feels like I'm about to do like a song on Solid Gold. Did you ever watch Solid Gold?
It was on in our house sometimes. I wouldn't say I watched it. I mean, you know.
But somebody was watching
it. Yeah, somebody in the house was watching it.
Who? I can't imagine anybody in your family.
Well, I don't remember.
Big disco freaks.
I don't remember. I mean.
I was into it.
But there.
If I had been of a slightly different age, I would have been a big disco guy.
But it was a. They just had, like, the popular performers of the day on it or something.
Yeah, it was, but it was fairly disco-themed.
I know, but it was like but, a, yeah. Kind of like an American Bandstand.
It was very disco. Like that, very like that.
All right, so who in my house would have...
Exactly.
Not my parents. But, I mean, they controlled the TV. I mean, if we were watching, say, the Dukes of Hazzard, they were being basically kind enough to let us watch it. It wasn't, you know, we didn't really control it.
Clearly, your dad was way into disco.
Or the Solid Gold Dancers or something.
That carried a lot of weight with me, I'll admit.
I mean, it's funny you should
later replaced by the Fly Girls.
It's something. It's funny you should say this because I think most people my age would say they're a child of the 80s. Usually when you say you're a child of a decade, it's the decade you were in high school and or college in, mm-hmm. which for me was the 80s. But I'm there not a go. Child of the 80s at all. I'm definitely a child of the 70s.
See, and I'm of, well, I'm sort of in between, but I generally, people my age generally tend to be considered child of the 90s, but I'm much more 80s because of my older siblings. A lot of my pop culture came through them, and they were like a decade older
mm-hmm,
than me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I was kind of in between generations. It gets confusing. I'm slightly too old to be a gen... I'm sorry, slightly too young to be a proper Gen Xer, but I'm slightly too old to be a proper Gen Y. It's very weird.
Yeah, I'm supposed to be in the Gen X.
Yeah, you're pretty
but,
set there.
But not. But it's just, I don't relate to that at all. Part of it is because we didn't have cable. I mean, for a lot of 80s kids,
that makes a lot
cable,
of difference
MTV,
for me too.
The whole
yeah,
thing.
Didn't have that.
That's a big deal. Well, I didn't have any of that.
Yeah.
So.
We had the, you know, four channels, and then on UHF I could kind of get like, you know, one
yeah,
or two.
Yeah. And then besides that, I mean, we grew up knowing who Cary Grant was and, you know, all of these old film stars and liking
yeah,
them. Like
yeah.
We were fans of these stars more than we were even of like of any 80s stars.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just, I don't know, we just come from a different
one of
time.
Our UHF channels. Back before it was adopted by anything, it eventually became the PAX network.
Yeah, yeah.
But before then, when it was just its own thing,
mm-hmm.
was Channel 22, and its call sign was KACH, and it was referred to and even was in their jingle as Catch 22.
Our station was...
That's what I grew up thinking that phrase was. It was years later before I found out that it was a book and had become an idiom
yeah, yeah.
that really is not something that you would necessarily associate your network with. So I don't know what
well,
the
Well, and it's not a positive thing, really.
Exactly, yeah.
Our station was KDSM Channel 17, and I think the first thing it became was Fox.
One of our UHF channels, Channel 49, became
yeah,
Fox.
Yeah. I think
and then we had a local, we had this one channel that was right in the middle. It was Channel 12 on VHF, and it was, it stayed a local affiliate forever. In fact, I think it stopped being independent when it became our UPN channel. That's how long it stayed independent. And now it's, I think it's sort of a Fox affiliate back in Oregon. I mean, I don't know. Any of you live in Oregon... What's Channel 12? No.
Well, do you do we have an Oregon listener in your old childhood hero commenting on the blog? That was kind of interesting.
Well, he's supposedly not in Oregon anymore. Okay. I looked up a thing, and he's actually he's doing a run somewhere I was not expecting.
Do you think that was really him?
I don't know. We've been recording for a while here. We should probably get into this.
Okay.
So, hello. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world designed specifically for people who can't stand the intensity, focus, and erudition of the average Seth Rogen film. I'm Tony.
And I'm William. This is episode 204.
Before we get into that, I just want to let me do the usual blurb. For those of you just joining us, I'm glad you made it in 5 minutes to find out that we were actually going to start. So, good job. I'd like to say that's unusual, but I don't feel like lying at this moment. William and I have a hat. It's magical. And in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. People who deep down inside know they're worth it, email this address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little notes, little comments, questions, topics, that sort of thing. And the hat, all on its own, magically transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that manifest physically within inside the hat itself. We, its ecclesiastical servants, I need more E words, draw those note cards out at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored, do that for about an hour. That's the show. So
hey,
welcome.
Before I forget, you know, this year we had a show on New Year's Day.
Yes, we did.
Or in 2 weeks we're going to have a show on the Chinese New Year. Ooh. It's going to start the year of the goat. What's your Chinese zodiac sign?
Well, this is a problem.
Problem.
Because as longtime listeners and big Tony fans know, Tony's birthday is on January 21st.
Yeah, before the Chinese New Year.
Exactly.
So if you were...
But restaurant placemats for decades were telling me... So I believe... See, I've gotten confused now. Technically, I'm in the Chinese New Year 76, although I was born in January 77.
You're the dragon.
I think that's the thing. For years, I thought I was Snake.
Yeah, no.
And I'm actually Dragon.
Yeah, you. The thing is, you don't even really have to know exactly when the Chinese New Year started in 77, because it's the second new moon, and there's no way you're...
Yeah, it's always in... Well, it's not always in February, but yeah, it's not going to hit the 21st.
No.
It's not going to hit before the 28th.
No, so you just got to be the dragon.
Okay, yeah, but before, but the 77 one is Snake, and so I spent most of my life thinking I was Snake. And here's the interesting thing. All the stuff on the placemats still applied. You know why? Because it's pretty much shit. No offense to the Chinese, the astrology stuff also pretty much shit.
Well, for the same reason...
I'm really embracing this atheism thing.
Kind of for the same reason I'm Year of the Monkey, because the second full... the second new moon of the year, which is right before the Chinese New Year, was on my birthday in 69. So, technically, I'm the Year of the Monkey, but my brother, whose birthday is February 14th, the previous year, is also Year of the Monkey. So, even though... We're a year apart in age. We're the same zodiac sign.
Mm.
But for a long time, like you, for a long time, I thought, well, it's Year of the Rooster. But and I was just a day off. But
this is the thing. People don't realize, he said, having just claimed all of this as bunk, astrology is way more precise and involved than restaurant placemats would have you believe. Or that newspaper columns would have you believe. Because... in the zodiac, the Western zodiac, I am an Aquarius in a bunch of ways. I am actually a triple Aquarius. My sun sign, my moon sign, and my ascendant sign are all Aquarius. But things you don't realize about that particular cosmology is, first of all, when people talk about what their sign is and what the newspapers say their sign is and all that, that is the sun sign. But that is only a small part of what your whole, like, chart would be.
Right.
Not a small part. It's a large part. Between the sun sign and the moon sign and the ascendant sign, you've got probably 80% of your influences there. But the other thing is people talk about, oh, it's from this date to this date. Oh, you were then? That's like cusp date. And that's bullshit. Cusps aren't a thing, people. I mean, they are in other places in life. But no, because on a given year, like, the planets and the stars and stuff were aligned in a specific way.
Yeah.
And so, yes, depending on the year, it may vary in that range. But like, and so I had somebody back when I believed in this stuff who actually did, well, not my full chart, but they did a bunch of stuff for me. And that was the thing. In 77, on January 21st, still definitely in the Aquarian house. Like by, and it's the thing, it's by a matter of hours. I believe later in that day, I might no longer have been an Aquarius, but I was born pretty early in the day.
Well, here's the part of astrology that they get right. And that is...
They're up? The planets are up?
That every person, depending on the exact moment they were born and the exact place they were born, is going to be in a completely unique orientation to everything in the universe.
Yes.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Now, whether or not the configuration of things in terms of planets and stars has any bearing on, therefore, what's going to happen to you for the rest of your life? Well, of course, that's a part I think they get wrong. But you can understand the allure. I mean,
well, and I won't even go that far.
There's like a celestial fingerprint to every single person that's unique.
It's entirely possible those things will have influence in ways that I don't understand. But what I claim is that the regular, identifiable via the art known as astrology influence that they claim it has... Not so much. I'm willing to believe that there's shit I don't know about.
No, that's true. That's true.
The stuff that they've invented, no.
It's hard. I mean, given what we do know, it's hard to imagine a mechanism that would allow that kind of influence that wouldn't completely overturn things that are not likely to ever get overturned.
Well, and in any sense of experimentation and so forth, you can't, it's unverifiable at this point.
Well,
and people are like, it's been going on for thousands of years, and it has been going on for thousands of years, which is an amazing testament to the power of culture, to the power of memetics, to the power of hegemony. and that in itself is fascinating and worth studying, but it doesn't prove that we're not deluded.
But do you see what I've been saying about how a lack of basic anthropological understanding is really hurting people
in
our culture? It's a real problem.
Preaching in the choir. Just today, I got to see, I think it was on Failbook, somebody posted, somebody made this really cool graphic that shows, that's an anti-evolution graphic, so hold on to your butts for this one. That shows the standard iconic image of a chimpanzee and all the crap in between, and then a person, you know, caveman.
Mm.
And it said, oh, if evolution is right, how come? And it says, there's millions of these, and it shows the chimps, which actually I'm not 100% sure is true at this point. They might be endangered. But anyway,
right.
There's millions of these, and it shows, why aren't there millions of the other ones? Ha! See?
Like, take that, atheists.
If...
Well, but I mean,
because you very astutely point out that iconic image is dumb as hell. You do point out that image is inaccurately portraying evolution.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
But I mean, even scientists, even some human behavioral scientists, exhibit this incredible ignorance when it comes to anthropological stuff. Like, I could just give a whole laundry list of things that scientists who otherwise are doing good work, when they start talking about their cultural biases that they don't think are cultural biases, and some of them think that because they're a scientist, they must not have any of those. Or some weird
and
thing like that.
And frequently, often hidden and unrealized even by them, common sense argument
that's just
nestled in there, and it's such a tiny step to there that they didn't even realize that. And sometimes if you can even point out the common sense thing, they would be aware. But somebody has to be there and point it out.
Well, but then what happens is they'll use these assumptions in their own scientific studies, not testing them or anything, just pointing out that everybody knows this is true. So now we're going to show you the science that proves it, which if you have an assumption and you go looking for the science that proves it, you're going to find it because that's a confirmation of a bias. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
And then
this stuff
a
goes.
Study is based on that, and then a different theory is based on that. Yeah. And now it's thousands of years later, and we're believing the zodiac.
But you know, like I say, anthropology. Why such profound ignorance about that field? It's been around for a while.
In forms, but it's also been messed up.
Oh, no, that's true. You're right.
When you go
that.
Through the history of it, there are some really shitty anthropologists out there. Who, to be fair, are completely seminal, and we couldn't have done it without them, but they were pretty shitty at it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of lack of understanding about, you know, sociology and other human behavioral sciences, but I think that most of the lack of understanding of those areas kind of starts with a lack of understanding of anthropology, because what people start with are cultural biases that they don't think are cultural biases. And so then they apply those to things like economics and psychology and sociology. And that, of course, that messes them up too.
Yeah.
So I think the anthropology piece is like the main missing piece. And if that piece was right,
leads to all sorts of things, like what I'm sure is probably one of your favorite phrases out there, social Darwinism. Isn't that fun?
Oh,
isn't that great?
Well, there are a lot of people that criticize that and then go on to create theories that are that subscribe to it.
Well, and I always love the social Darwinism is the most institutionalized example, but I always love the metaphor ones. And actually, if you really want to find some good ones, watch All the President's Men, because they're constantly doing it to each other. But this idea that I say something that makes a rational argument, but I'm talking about tadpoles or something, so of course it still applies to you and me here. Like, no. That the one that I always remember from All the President's Men is, I go to sleep at night, there's no snow. When I wake up in the morning, there's snow on the ground. I didn't see it snow, but I can tell it snowed. And I'm like, that's pretty accurate. You can't necessarily attach that to anything else.
Right. Oh, you mean like say, science tells us that energy is not created or destroyed. Therefore, when I die, I must live on because...
Bingo.
I mean, bingo. That's another big one.
Yep.
Which I'm not disparaging a person who thinks we live on, but to tie it to this scientific concept of the conservation of energy is not intellectually
humans
honest.
Are the only people who invented elections, therefore they're unnatural. Giraffes don't vote. What makes us so special?
I mean, think of how long we could go on with absurdities like this.
There are a ton of things giraffes don't do.
That are nevertheless natural.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, man, this will be awesome. I'm just, from now on, all of my bases of how humanity should live is, have you seen a giraffe do it?
No. Then don't
then
do it.
Then it's unnatural. Dude, that's my new moral compass. Do giraffes do it? If yes, all right. If no. So I'm going to start whipping my neck around and slamming my head into other people. Because have you seen giraffes do that? That shit is fucked up. Have you seen that?
Don't forget to eat what they eat. Because
absolutely.
That's the original
only
diet.
Only the tallest.
That's the
and
original.
I bring up giraffes. Oh my God, do you remember the Lamarckian evolution?
No.
Oh, come on. This is the favorite thing in the world. So originally, giraffes have little tiny necks.
Okay.
But they need to get to the more leaves because they eat all the lower leaves. So they stretch and they stretch and they stretch their neck a little bit in their lifetime. And then they have a baby and the baby has a slightly longer neck.
Right.
This was a genuine evolutionary theory back in the day. That's how the giraffes get it, is each generation stretches a little further to reach those taller leaves.
That doesn't make any sense, really.
But it was a major evolutionary theory.
Now we do have epigenetics now that does that, and so that there are
those
some
are genetics that you apply directly to the skin.
No, they're the kinds of things that can manifest through behavioral changes in the offspring, but not quite like what that's talking about, especially since what a more sensible Darwinian explanation would be is that, you know, by a random mutation, an animal with a slightly larger neck can reach more food and therefore is
more prone to survival, yeah, and exactly. Therefore more prone to of course, yeah. And this is the thing that bugged me, as I've said many times, and I'm still playing it. My second favorite video game series in the world right now is Assassin's Creed.
What was your first favorite again?
Mass Effect.
Okay, yeah.
But it is based on a very popular science fiction theory that is just the worst thing ever. And it shows up in a lot of places. And this is the idea of genetic memory.
Yeah, yeah.
In the sense that in your genes, you can, like, learn how your ancestors... And in this game series, this machine helps you go back and relive the lives of your ancestors via your genetics. And I'm like, this is the worst science ever. But the game doesn't work without it. I mean, you couldn't pull this off otherwise. And that's the thing. Like, yes, you could just do games that are those ancestors. But no, the fact that we're looking back at this modern day and we're learning stuff is a major part of the whole plot. And you absolutely need it or the game doesn't happen. But it's the dumbest fucking thing. And it shows up in a lot of places. Ugh. Drives me crazy. Still like the games. I'm almost done with Assassin's Creed Black Flag. And I have finally figured out what I'm going to play next.
What's that?
Witcher 2. Not on console, just on my computer, because I have it.
I didn't know you played the first Witcher.
I did play the first Witcher, and I enjoyed it. And from what I've been told, the second Witcher is quite a lot better. I got into an interesting debate the other day with somebody about this. Are you familiar with the term Mary Sue?
Yes.
Please try and give us a relative definition of the term.
Well, my understanding is that if I know the sense that you mean... It is
in a narrative sense. It's specifically invented as a thing involving fan fiction.
Yes, right.
It can be used in a general narrative sense at this point.
Well, okay. The way I understand it is it's when a person writes a story and it becomes very clear that they are imagining themselves as the main character, and the clues to this usually are, I don't know, you just get the sense that the person is living out some of their own fantasies and telling this story.
Yes. Apparently, the term came up because someone back in the earlier days of fan fiction wrote a parody. We had to look this up because the producer and I were in a debate about this. Wrote a parody Star Trek fan fiction, specifically making fun of authors that did this all the time, where there would suddenly be this 15-year-old girl who was the youngest lieutenant ever in Starfleet and would be on the Enterprise and would save the day, and all the main canon characters would fall in love with them, you know? And so she wrote one of these, and the character in question was named Mary Sue. And I feel, and for those of you not familiar, The Witcher is a fantasy series of games that is based off of an incredibly popular Polish series of fantasy novels.
Yeah, I think I was aware of that.
Actually. That are all based on this particular character. And to me, they're incredibly Mary Sue, because the character just feels like a dude I rolled up in D&D when I was 12. I mean, he's this badass hero. Like, he's super badass. He has long white hair and freaky gold-colored eyes. Otherwise, he's very handsome, though. And all the women want him. He sleeps with so many damn women. And he dual-wields two swords, one of which is just a regular sword and one of which is made out of silver. And he goes around and he saves everybody all the time. But he's very aloof. Like, he's just, oh my god, he's such that character. Despite that, it's fun to play. And especially, it works for a video game thing. Mary Sue game works pretty well as a video game because you're just playing that character. So.
Yeah.
But we will see how that goes down.
And that's what you're talking about. That's one of the ways that people suspect that this is a fantasy of the author, is that the main character is so...
Frequently they border on invincible.
Yeah.
And just very... very good at whatever they do.
And not, but the story revolves around them to a degree that is beyond a typical protagonist or even a hero. It's like, there's not
their
even really...
setbacks tend to be minor.
Yeah.
If at all.
Well, they would be minor. They're minor for them, not for anybody else. For anybody else, they would be overwhelming and horrible. But yes. For them, it's just a walk.
Well,
in the park.
That's why in the video games, at least in the first one, you had to start by and this is an old trope in video games, but it works pretty well, and it works here. Having amnesia, of course. So everybody else knew how cool I was, but I slowly had to learn over time how cool I was to make it an effective video game. Speaking of Mary Sue, the audiobook I'm now reading, Ready Player One, I put this in the same category. Our protagonist is an 18-year-old boy who is doing a lot of virtual reality stuff to try and win a contest that's worth billions of dollars, and so consequently there are people out there who are willing to kill for it and things like that. And it's all based on riddles and puzzles from an eccentric dead billionaire who was obsessed with both video games and the 1980s. And so our protagonist has studied the crap out of all of this, and he's sort of unique in that he's really obsessively studied, so he knows everything. And, it's and we go into great lengths about how much he has worked on this. And I knew this guy. I gamed with this guy. I was in games this guy ran, you know, and there was always that one NPC that was too badass.
I always thought that the Twilight series was vaguely Mary Sue.
Oh, yeah.
And I say vaguely because it's not over the top Mary Sue, but it does seem like, and I read a chapter or two just to see, well, mm-hmm. was it even well written, or, you know, because I'd heard so much about it, and I knew that just based on the plot and a few other things that it was probably something I would think was terrible, and I didn't think it was well written either, but I got the clear impression that and maybe this isn't true, but this is what it seemed like, mm-hmm. was that the author had written a kind of journal when she was in junior high and high school, and to sort of help her feel better about the fact that every time she saw this guy she liked, he looked at her like she was, this horrible thing.
Yeah.
Because that's what happens in the novel, I guess. He gives her this terrible look, and so she thinks he doesn't like her at all, but it's actually...
He likes her too much.
Yeah, he likes her too much. Yes. It's like, wow, That's what every person would like to think, that when the person they are attracted to looks at them like they're a freak, that it's actually because they like them too much.
Yeah.
And so I thought, this is all material from her junior high and high school journal. And, I mean, of course, I don't know if that's true, but it just read that way to me.
It does have that feeling. And then, of course, the ultimate expression of this, then, speaking of Twilight, was 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, which
because
was
based that on literally was a fan fiction.
You know what I just heard in the car before I came in here was that there's this company called Vermont Teddy Bears or something where you can get teddy bears. And for Valentine's Day, they have a 50 Shades of Grey teddy bear.
Of course.
They said including accessories. They didn't say what the accessories were, but I'm sure we can all guess.
Seriously?
is it a teddy bear
that actually has a butthole?
I have no idea.
I don't know enough about 50 Shades of Grey except to know that it involves some butt stuff.
Well,
that's kind of a focal point at times.
The thing is, you know, there's this other company that a lot of us around here are familiar with because it's in all the malls. It's and they you can go in and you can buy a teddy bear, but they stuff it there while you're there.
Build-A-Bear,
right? So it's probably kind of like that. And so it's like going into Build-A-Bear and saying, do you have a 50 Shades of Grey?
My child would like the Christian Grey Build-A-Bear. And by the way, full disclaimer here, I don't judge people's porn. Believe me. As long as everybody involved in the making of said porn is of legal age and is consenting.
And consenting, sure.
I don't judge
anybody's
porn. I do judge making it into a popular movement. I do judge mainstreaming your porn to
well,
I
but
guess.
Also of fiction that I don't think anyone thinks is very well written. I mean, maybe they like it, maybe they're into it, but they surely even the people who are fans can't think that this is very well written.
And I read poorly written porn because without going into too much detail, porn is for specific things. Well, okay, let's see. I can even do that. Porn is for evoking specific fantasy images within your head. Porn is not porn, in the truest sense, is not necessarily for a narrative purpose. Don't get me wrong. There are narratives that include erotic elements that are perfectly good. But if you're talking about porn, it's not largely supposed to be for narrative discussion and introspection and so forth. It's to evoke erotic images and concepts within your head.
And that's fine.
And but within certain boundaries, that doesn't require really good reading. But when you make it into a book and you sell it and you start doing themed things based on it and teddy bears, no.
And films, yeah.
What are we, Japan? I mean, come on. Sorry. Had to be said, because they do it.
I mean, but, again, I'm not... I'm not a literature snob by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I have no problem with, you know, different writing styles.
He doesn't read books. So
and something
fine.
Being really popular that's not very well written. Don't like, well, for example, the novelization of Star Wars that George Lucas wrote is not well written. It's every bit as poorly written as the books we've already talked about.
Fill in the blank that George Lucas wrote is not well written.
But but it's fine. I mean, you know, it was popular. It was a best-selling novel, and it's got, you know, historical import, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. But everybody, here's the thing. Everybody acknowledges that it's not very well written.
Yeah.
And that's okay. But it seems like things like Twilight and Shades of Grey, it seems like there's a reluctance of people who I'm sure know better to say, well, yeah, it's not very well written, but I like it because of X, Y, or Z. That's fair. But
yeah.
To make it sound like it's got some literary value
I don't know. I mean, and weirdly, I have different issues with Shades of Grey than I do with Twilight. Twilight, I just don't like it. And I'm okay with other people liking it, and I don't.
Well, I don't care.
I'm a little scared of its social impact, because Twilight has some weird assumptions in it.
I'm not sure it has a social impact so much as it reveals something about our society.
50 Shades... What I'm saying is I would be perfectly comfortable with 50 Shades if I ran into it on a popular but not often talked about website. I'm not as comfortable.
Which is kind of where it started
what
I understand.
And then, but I just find it so sort of ridiculous that it's just...
Well, but doesn't it say something about the culture we're in? I mean, that's what it's about,
yeah,
right?
And actually... It does say something about the culture, and that being said, I actually can see it in a positive light, because I feel like we've been doing a lot of sex shaming in our society for quite a while, and I feel like this is a step, admittedly a step that also goes kind of sideways, but a step in which people who wouldn't before can come out and say, this turns me on, and I'm going to read it, and that's okay.
Well, yeah, I suppose.
It has a lot of other issues that are problematic on top of that, but that single aspect could be viewed as positive.
Well, positive, negative, I mean, I don't know either way. All I'm saying is that, I mean, it is what it is, and if people like it, great. I mean, I don't, you know, best-selling, it's on the bestsellers,
that's
fine.
Let the market decide.
Yeah, I don't really care, but...
Except for hand-washing. Wash your damn hands.
But it's just... I don't know.
That sounded weird in the context of the porn. I should specify, I'm making an oblique reference to the guy, the senator, who recently talked about how he thought there shouldn't be a regulation for having to wash your hands, which is really freaky. I'm not trying to connect that to the porn. You're sick people. Don't think of that.
There's just a temptation when these things happen to... And again, I do think they say something about the culture, and I think it's important... to kind of look at that and learn from it. But there's a temptation to make these things into something they're not.
Well, and...
And I think that's a mistake for everybody.
Possibly
sake.
The most important point for something like this, when you take what is essentially erotic fan fiction from a website someplace, and then you turn it into a book, and you mass produce it, and you make campaigns, and you make teddy bears and all that. The important thing to remember, giraffes don't do it. So it's unnatural.
Yes.
Giraffes don't do this with their erotic fan fiction.
But to tell people it's unnatural just makes them more interested in it, I think.
That's a good point.
Now, I wish they could see the look on your face when you said that.
Now I want to write an erotic piece of fan fiction just called Giraffes Don't Do It. My lover and I did things. I won't say what, but I'll just say giraffes would never. They would never do that.
They would never even think.
They wouldn't.
In fact, a giraffe might die if you talked about it in front of them.
Giraffe doesn't have the leg strength. Wait, sorry. I've said too much. Yeah, this is... I love when it's just such a simple answer to what the episode's going to be called. It's just right there.
I have no idea what this conversation has been about. I'm going to listen to this later and think, oh, why did I say that? That was a dumb thing to say.
Because
I hate offending people, because I don't really judge people based on what they do or read or anything else. But sometimes if I don't explicitly say that, someone might get that from something I'm saying.
I feel like the overall Venn diagram of big, like, hardcore fans of 50 Shades of Grey and hat listeners, not a whole bunch of overlap.
I'm willing
to acknowledge some.
You asked about my week, and that there is something I was going to talk about, and it's related to this.
50 Shades?
No, it's that this week was sort of bittersweet for me because, I mean, ever since I left home in 1987, this story goes way back. It's not going to be a long story, though. I've been trying to figure out how I can make the world a better place. I mean, that's where I come from. That's what you do. That's mm-hmm. what your mission in life, everyone's mission in life is that. And that's what I've been trying to do. And to do that, I look for allies. I look for people who maybe have a similar outlook that I have.
You're running for president in 2016, aren't you?
No. This week, I think I reached a new point. This has happened several times in my life, but this is a new sort of pinnacle of I'm never going to find these people. These people just don't exist. I mean, as soon as I think, oh, okay, well, I have a philosophy that a lot of people seem to call this, so I'll find other people who call themselves that. I find those people, and none of them see this thing the same way I do. I mean, not just a little bit different. Completely different.
Yeah, yeah.
So those people don't even like me. I'll go over here, and I am never going to find these people. These people don't exist, and it's bittersweet because on one hand it's sad, but on the other hand it's like, okay, so I can just quit even trying to do this. But part of what made me realize this is, and again how it relates to what we were just talking about is, you can't. It's like you can't talk about anything anymore, like expressing an opinion, without someone trying to put you in some kind of category on some extreme that you don't belong in.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure anybody does, but for whatever reason, it's just a popular thing when you talk about something, if you don't preface it or afterwards have a whole bunch of disclaimers, like we often do about, I'm not criticizing what anyone else does. People are going to think that's what you're doing. So you have to spend, four-fifths of your time explaining what you're not saying before you can actually say what you want to say. And that's just tiring and ridiculous and a waste of time. So
it is.
I mean, I don't know.
I have some things to say about this. I do agree with you to a certain degree that you may never find those people. And I understand the importance of that. I mean, it's a classic psychological condition, the whole wanting to belong.
Oh, sure.
Wanting to find people who are like you.
That's right.
That's a thing, and I understand it, and I do feel
both sympathetic
and empathetic pain for you of not having that. Because I have similar things. I can find people who I relate to in this way, but it often seems really narrow. Or if I think it's not narrow, as I get to know them more and things, I realize, it's not so much. Mm-hmm. But you need to be aware that that's not only okay, it's kind of good, because it gives you a very unique gift that you should share. You should not go looking for people who think like you necessarily. You should go talk to people who are willing to listen to the way you think and you can share with them, and you can influence them, and you can teach, and you can learn from them. And I know, to your second point, of you come to people and you say something, and they immediately try and, you know, pigeonhole you or categorize you or whatever. That is true, and that is something that is very difficult to avoid. But you know it can happen because you know individuals for whom that is, if not not true, less true. Me, for example, I like to think that although we do have times where we have some difficulty because there are some assumptions and we sort of have to hash out what we're saying, in general, you can tell me your views and you trust that I will largely hear them.
Oh, absolutely.
And even to a certain degree, understand them, whether I agree with them or
right,
not.
No, that's right, that's right.
And you know other people. I'm not the only one.
No, that's true.
It's less cool than being able to get on the internet and think that you're talking to a community of people or hundreds of people. But seeking out those individuals and those small groups who don't necessarily even have to agree with you, but who are the type who will listen to you and who are the type who will share with you and who are the type who will validate and appreciate your point of view is absolutely doable. And I think something you do. You just got to learn to realize the significance of that and sort of don't worry about the rest, which is an ideal, not something you can just do, because I have it to this day. I still struggle with, I want to join this community. But I don't really
Well,
and the fact that so much of my political and social activism is non-existent for that exact reason. Every movement out there, I'm like, well.
Okay, but.
And also I'm really lazy.
And everything you've said is right, and it speaks to the psychological and sociological realities of it. But those are actually kind of a minor aspect of it. You know, for example, I'm actually not particularly interested in finding people who agree with me because that's not helpful to me. The main interest I have in finding other people to share ideas with is because I need help to accomplish the things I want to accomplish. So I'm looking for collaborators. I'm looking for people actually to challenge my ideas so that I can make them better. Instead, not just if I tell someone an idea for them to tell me back that I'm saying something that I'm not saying because they're marginalizing me.
Yeah.
Or, I need someone to say, well, that's got problems because of X, Y, or Z, but I want them to know what I just said or else they can't adequately do that.
You want them to actually be responding
to your
message.
So if identifying as an anarchist, for example, which I still do, what I want when I talk to other anarchists is for them to help me refine my understanding of that, not for them to say, well, you're not the kind of anarchist I am, which means you're the wrong kind of anarchist.
Yeah.
But that's what I get.
Yes.
Now, what I'm realizing is that you told me once that, William, what you have to realize is that a lot of people who feel strongly enough about something to talk about it on the internet are probably going to be jerks about it somehow. What I think it actually goes further than that. I think that most people who feel strongly enough about something to give themselves a label about it, like an anarchist, for example, are probably also going to be jerks about it, or else they wouldn't go to the trouble of giving themselves that
label. I think you're right, and this travels in a lot of things, because to a lesser degree, there's the version of, and I think it's becoming less of a thing because there's a cultural shift, but if you're single and you're looking for someone, odds are the kind of person you want to find is not the kind of person you find on a singles dating site, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what I would advise you here, because this episode is me fixing you, what I would advise
aren't they
you
all
here.
All that? I thought all of the episodes were.
Yeah, but for once, I actually have an idea. 203 others that are like,
But you said things anyway.
We got an hour to kill. No, my advice to you in this one is I think you have to approach it socially. And let me explain what I mean by that. I think you need to, and this can be done online. It's probably of more benefit to you to be done in person, but it can be done online. Go meet people and make friends. And over time, you may find that some of them share similar views. But the problem is going to a group of anarchists and say, let's talk anarchy. I think it's a problem. What you have to do is go to Janine and say, hey, I'm William, and you guys do something,
hang out, and
eventually you find out she's a little bit anarchist too. Only maybe a little, but she is. Or maybe even she's a serious anarchist, but she doesn't feel the need to lead with that, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And it's harder because it's one at a time, and because for any given specific goal, your odds are really low.
Well,
but having more friends and I'm betting there's a lot of issues like this, not just anarchism. You know, there's other things.
Oh yeah, and just so about everything I think and believe has these problems.
But I do think that you are so interested in collaboration. Don't look at it from a logistical point of view. Look at it from a social point of view. If you want to collaborate, get to know more people and make more friends. You're gonna find people who will want to collaborate with you on something.
Well, and the two reasons that I've classically struggled with that very thing, two reasons. One, because I'm an introvert, and
which is a huge one.
I have a hard time with that. And the second thing is, for the most part, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I don't really have an idea of even what I should be doing. So, but of course.
But I think what I've suggested lends itself to that.
No, I agree. I mean,
but the first one is huge.
Yeah, actually, and you know, like, the whole thing with the Briar Rose project, you know, that I almost didn't even talk about that in the podcast because I thought, who's going to care about that? But see, that's the exact wrong way to think about it.
Yep.
And of course, I did talk about it on the podcast, and you could see it in a way that I wasn't able to because of the two problems I just mentioned. And then that brought people to the project. And so, you know, now it's something that it might actually happen, and it's in the process of happening. So yeah, I just... It's just something I've always struggled with, but you're right. Everything you said is right. It's something I kind of need to get past and get over.
And introversion is a thing, but that's I may have misspoke when I said the internet might not be the way to do it. There are great ways to interact socially with people online that can lend itself to introverts because of the sort of comfort of doing it behind the screen. So maybe check, you know, to put it in a term that, you know, Second Life.
Mm-hmm.
That could be a good kind of thing. This could be something you check out. The other thing I'd say, though, is introverts have spoken since the internet has been around. And there's lots of stuff on how introverts can do what they want socially despite these tendencies. So it might be worth looking into. But I think if you just approach it from not from the perspective of this is a thing I want to do, this is the thing I want to do, but just getting to know more people, I think things will eventually present themselves.
I'm sure that's true.
And I say all this knowing the scope of what I'm talking about. It's not easy. It's not easy for me. And A, I'm way more extroverted, and B, I'm way less interested in dealing with other people. And even then, when I try and do it, it's hard for me. So I can only imagine. But I do think you're right. I think in general, people, and it's not necessarily about identifying with that. I mean, I identify as a feminist, and I don't consider myself problematically feminist. But people who essentially lead with their label as they shake your hand... Well, can be problematic.
But that's never the problem. The problem is you get to know somebody and then they find out that you have a particular view that they happen to have some polarizing opinion about, and then it just falls apart after that. And then they feel like they were deceived by you to, you know, oh, you tricked me into thinking you were a normal person, but you're not.
Well,
I mean, that's happened to me. Way too many times.
Yeah, and not to sound too much like the mother who says, well, then they weren't really your friends. But there are quite a lot of people who aren't like that.
I know, but...
And that's a fault that lies in those people. And, I mean, I've had that. I've had friends that have surprised me with all sorts of interesting things like that. The one that stands out most is the person who claimed that... Che and Castro were their personal heroes. And this came from a late teens lesbian woman that I knew. And that was a real hard one to cope with on a lot of levels.
But that's not unusual, though, is it? I mean, it seems like I've met people like that before.
This was my first.
Oh.
And especially ones who, demographically speaking, would have totally been slaughtered under those regimes. Mm. I found very weird.
Mm.
But you keep an open mind. Because that's the thing. If you've gotten to know someone, you're like, okay, I know them. And so I know them saying this didn't change who they were. But there's a lot of people who aren't like that. And that's a problem.
Does the world just seem more judgy? I mean,
yeah.
And I don't think
I always wonder how much has the world become more judgy, and how much is, as we get older and the world gets more connected, are we more aware of the judginess that was already there? I never know which the answer is.
I suppose.
I work really hard to judge in situations that don't matter.
Well, I have a...
I like being judgmental. It's fun. People get into being judgy. It makes you feel superior. And so I try and do it on shit that doesn't matter, like making fun of Canadians or getting really bitchy about the people on Project Runway. And I don't go on the internet and bitch about them there where they might actually see it and feel horrible about themselves.
Well,
I just bitch to my wife in our family room, you know? It's way nicer. And it gets it sort of out of my system. But yeah, judgment, and what my mother always referred to, because my mother took some courses that were very enlightening for her, that were from a group that later got proved to be a cult. But luckily she was only in the early stages, so she never experienced the cult stuff. But anyway, they discussed the concept of other person's viewpoint. And it is a very important skill, and it is a skill that many people lack. And giraffes don't have it at all.
No.
The ability, essentially it's empathy, but the ability to, in a situation, say, where are they coming from? And it can be universally applied, and not to Godwin's law the fuck out of this, but you can sit there and go, think about where Hitler was coming from. I'm not justifying anything he did, but I'm saying most people are like, oh, Hitler did what he did because he was evil. No, that's not a thing.
No.
There are reasons. They might be shitty reasons, and he might still have been an asshole. In fact, pretty sure he was an asshole. But there are reasons that to him made sense. He's not just like, oh, you know what'll be fun? Evil. that doesn't happen.
The interesting thing, though, about what's going on now is you've kind of got two kinds of experiences you run into out there. One is people are either being really harshly judgmental, or people are saying you shouldn't judge anything, which neither one of those things is right. No. We just, you
and
know, you have to make judgments.
I run into, I, and this is very common for Aquarians,
which I am also.
They tend to be open-minded to a fault, supposedly, and I do have that tendency where I want to be open-minded really heavily, but to a degree then that I don't pick a side ever. Kind of thing. And I've tried to work on that, and luckily as I get older I get more judgy. So I'm balancing out a little bit.
Well, but we have to make judgments. It's not making judgments isn't the problem.
You just have to be aware that they're a personal judgment of yours.
Yeah, and insisting that other people have to judge things the same way you
exactly.
do. That's the problem.
You can judge, you just have to say, this is my judgment.
Yeah,
it doesn't
opinion.
Mean it's truth.
But so then you go out and you express an opinion, which is perfectly valid to do, and because you're making a judgment that's perfectly valid to make, people think you're judgy.
No, well and...
I'm not telling you how to think, I'm just telling you how I think.
And the hyper-judgy people will disagree with you're doing it wrong, therefore you're wrong. And the people who don't think you should judge don't like you for making a judgment.
They're going to be judgy about you
being And this
judgy.
Is the thing.
It's so weird.
And this is not me just shitting on the world, although I love to do that. For a given individual... And you are a given individual.
Thank you. Because usually you say I'm
That's
not.
That's the nicest thing I can say about you. You're a given individual. What do you think of William? Well, he's a given individual.
That's probably
not
nicest.
Giving. Given.
That's one of the nicest thing anybody's said about me.
For a given individual, most people are going to suck.
I don't see why that has to be true.
I don't know why it has to be true, and I don't see why either, but it happens. Most people I meet in the day are not people I want to be friends with.
Well,
and it's,
I don't know.
And it's hard to get knocked down 10 times by assholes.
Well, and it's, I think it's a little harder for an introverted person.
I think it's a lot harder
because
for an introverted
it
person.
It takes a lot
because
to make
you
that
make
connection
the
in the
effort
first. Yeah.
And then get knocked down 10
right.
times in a row.
It's not
for me, it's not such a big deal. It's a less of an investment.
But another thing is, though, for me personally, this is something that I think you will agree is an aspect of my personality, is I can't help it. This isn't something I think is great about me or something. Or
is this how you're really racist?
No, it's I like people. I mean, I almost immediately like a person.
Yeah.
Like, right away. I'm going to notice something about them that I like. I could probably, after knowing someone or just watching someone for 2 seconds, walk up to them and pay them a compliment about something that I like about them, whether that's their smile or their laugh or the way they treat their spouse or their kid, you know, or, the, you know, any whatever, because I like people. And so it kind of stings when I go to make some kind of connection and I think I'm doing something that's perfectly human and innocent, and I get treated like I'm some kind of creep or I'm some kind of trying to manipulate them in some way.
And it's interesting, for all of our discussions of rationality and emotion and not sort of being ruled by it or whatever, you are quite emotionally sensitive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I am.
And this is the thing I love about you. You sort of refuse to grow a thick skin about it. You sort of refuse to become jaded. You will rather withdraw than let yourself become jaded. And that's incredibly admirable, but of course it makes life hard.
Well, I don't know how admirable it is. I mean,
I like it. I'm impressed by it, and I wish I could do it, honestly.
Well, you know, to me, it's better than the alternative. I don't want.
Well, of course.
I don't
want
to be.
I know that it's a conscious choice on your part.
Yeah, I mean,
because trust me, it's really easy to grow thick skin if you need to.
As you know, I had a really terrible year last year.
Yeah.
The worst ever, and all I can think about after that year is, okay, what do I need to do now, so that I don't become bitter? You know what I'm saying? That whatever this year is, that I get over it. And that someday people will be surprised I even had a year like this, because I don't seem like the kind of guy that would have gone through something
like
that.
And I think that's the healthiest choice, and I'm very proud of you for that.
I don't,
but it's the choice that is the hardest. It's the choice that takes the longest.
Yeah, but it's not forever.
No, I mean, absolutely.
You know, it's
absolutely. I think, like I said, I think it's the healthiest choice, and I think it's the best choice. In your situation, it is the choice I would hope I would make. But it is the longer road, and it is the harder road.
Yeah, but what's the alternative?
The alternative is to become bitter and to become jaded and delude yourself, essentially.
Yeah, but then you feel awful all the time forever.
Yeah,
instead of feeling
then,
awful for a little while.
No, but then your perspective on what's awful and what's okay changes.
Yeah, that's
scary. There's a lot of people out there who are less happy than you are right now who would rate themselves happier than you are right now.
Really?
Yes. Yes. Because happy is a very subjective position. And first of all, people can find happiness in different things, of course. But also, happiness can be about what you've convinced yourself makes you happy.
Yeah, that's right.
Not necessarily what does make you happy. And people who you look at them and you're like, I don't think they're really happy, but they think they're happy. They probably don't spend a lot of time really thinking about whether or not they're happy.
Well, you know,
and you can overdo that.
When it comes,
I can think about whether I'm happy long enough to make myself unhappy.
No, that's right.
But there's a happy medium.
But when you
also, fire truck is going past, so let's hope that that's not. I did not mean that.
When it comes to this topic, though, I probably have a benefit that a lot of other people don't have, which is I decided at a very young age what was going to make me feel fulfilled in my life, and I've pretty much never changed my mind about that. And a lot of people can't say that. A lot of people,
no,
They have no clue what's going to make them feel fulfilled, and they change, and which is okay. You don't have to know, and you can change it. It can evolve. Like, maybe you don't think having kids is going to fulfill you. Then you have kids, and you realize, wow, this is the thing that I was made for. And that's great.
And you never have any doubt? Because that's the first thing is any decision made at a young age.
Well, it's because it's been reinforced through all kinds of other experiences for my entire life.
And you what I think are some of your biggest strengths is you are very thoughtful and you're very introspective, and that makes it harder to fool yourself, but it makes you more successful at getting what you actually want.
Boy, really?
Yes.
Wow.
No.
I don't feel very successful at getting the things
I want. It doesn't help you get things. Helps you get what you want. If you're not introspective and you're not thoughtful, you can accomplish a lot of things that may not have been you wanted.
I get what you mean.
And you can dedicate your whole life to that. And then at the end, or maybe never, you're like, oh, wait, no, that wasn't it. Which is why you hear about people in their 60s, literally married for 40 years, one day get divorced and pursue a brand new career or something.
Yeah.
Because they didn't think about it and realize it till then. And you decided really early on, which honestly is generally not a good thing, because a lot of people do that and then they just stick with it and they go through changes and their life changes. But you are so introspective that you are reevaluating all the time.
Well, keep in mind, the thing I'm talking about is it's not like a specific thing, like I'm going
to
make $1 billion a
year
by the time
I'm 30. You wanted to be a cobbler.
No, I want to make the
peach
world
cobbler.
A better place, which
I wanted to be a peach cobbler.
Which means that's going to change
shoes for peaches,
regardless of where I'm at.
Sorry, I just made myself laugh so bad.
Obviously,
come on, that was great. You wanted to be a cobbler, a peach cobbler. I wanted to be a peach cobbler, make shoes for peaches. That is just layers upon layers of comedy gold.
Yeah. Now you've got something competing with the giraffe thing for the title.
No. Giraffes don't do that. Okay. Giraffes don't change the titles.
They don't make shoes for
also
peaches.
Also true. We are over time now, and we haven't touched the hat, so let's get something
out
of the
hat. We didn't talk about your week. I'm sorry.
My week didn't have much going on. We finally started book 7 of Dresden Files with the producer. But that's about it. I'm almost done with Black Flag. That's about it.
If you were going to be a character in a book or movie, who would it be?
Batman.
I won't say something that I've written, because that would be too very silly.
Oh, that would be hilarious. I've got this character in one of my novels. His name is Mary Sue.
There are characters in my stuff that I'd like to...
There have been characters in lots of things that I've felt that way. Yeah. As I get older, not so much. I feel more... I'd rather be me.
Well, and we all know that's how I feel about it.
You'd rather be me?
No, I've never felt like I want to be a certain historical figure or a person in fiction. It's just, I don't think like that. But since we've made everybody listen to all of this rigmarole to this point, I can try to come up with something.
Yeah.
So I'll try if you come up with something first. I have to think about it.
Well, I mean, I pull from places. I don't know that I can give you specific. The obvious one, as an individual with some gender identity issues, there have been lots of times I've wished I could be various female characters, but that's largely to do with the femininity and the physiology and all that, and less to do with the crux of the narrative or anything like that. This is a very hard one for me.
It is? Really?
It really is.
I'm trying to think. There must have been...
Because it's like, oh, that would be awesome. Would it be better than just being me?
I think there might have been times where I saw a character that I thought, it would be cool to be that person, but to be the one who is where that person is.
Yeah.
If you know what I'm saying. Like, I don't want to be him, but the job he's doing or the associations he has or whatever, that would be cool.
Yeah, and I can do a version of that. There are things where I'm like, I'd like to be that person for a week or something, you know.
Oh, there's got to be. I know that there's been times where I've thought, hey, it would be cool to be where
like,
that guy is.
I like
not
being,
so much be the guy.
I like being I like being Gandalf. I like being the wise old mentor thing. I like.
Oh yeah.
I enjoy, you know, being Liam Neeson's character in Batman Begins, which is how I refer to him. I don't call him by his title because I think he did a poor version of that character.
Or maybe Qui-Gon Jinn.
Yeah, like just I
or
like,
Obi-Wan, the old Obi-Wan.
And honestly, there's some of that is a bit of the idea of being worshipped, I'm honest, because that is what we're talking about to a certain degree. There's a certain, oh, they're the experts and they know, and that's the thing. Except in more postmodern tales, generally speaking, that character is sort of infallible,
I guess. For me, it's more of a,
and I enjoy that,
it's more of a Merlin trope where you're not the person at the front.
Yeah,
you're
the power behind,
and not the power behind, but just the person helping. Like, maybe a better example would be Kermit. That's the guy I want to be. I want to be the guy
with Jim Henson's hand up.
No, no, no. Like, you know, the guy who is putting on the show, but not the star of the show. Yeah. You know what I'm trying to say?
And I get that, and I don't want to be unknown. Like, I'm never, I need a little bit, I need a little bit of the recognition, but I can be recognition as the kingmaker rather than the king. By the way, just have to throw this in here because you made me think of it just now. At Midnight episode I watched a little while back had rejected Muppets as its hashtag thing to do. And so people were calling out rejected Muppets and there were various ones, including tasteless ones and all that. And some that were funny and some that weren't, but one that just drove me nuts. I loved it so much. One of them buzzed in and just said, Jim Henson's naked hand.
I don't know if that was a rejected one.
That would be a terrible Muppet.
I'm sure you'd be surprised how expressive it could be.
Oh no, I'm frequently doing that kind of thing. Yeah. I'm there. Senor Wences did his thing with yes, open your mouth. Okay. Wire? Yes. Wire? Yes. Not that wide. Okay, sorry.
So you know who that is, huh?
That's
that's not before your
probably
time?
Exclusively from the Muppet Show.
Oh, okay.
But yes, I do know Senor Wences. It's all right? It's all right.
Well, okay. No, that's true. That show was really good about introducing some old vaudevillian.
Absolutely. The last vaudeville folks were there.
Yeah. Boy, that was a great show.
That's who I want to be. I want to be Senior Wences. Sorry, I feel like we didn't... Was this anonymous?
Yeah.
Well, fuck you anyway. But we didn't do real good on this, but we are way over time, so...
Sorry. It's my fault for talking about all this stuff.
No, I thought we had a really interesting conversation. And honestly... I think this is a hard question for us to answer because we are fair. I mean, I like to play pretend, but I still like to be me. At the end of, I mean, I will play, I game. I love playing characters that are nothing like me because I know I can come back to being me.
But they're also in you. I mean, you and I have a very fluid definition of identity, which...
I think that's
I don't
not
think,
untrue as
I
well.
I don't think that's just... our own personal definition of identity. I think identity really works that way, and I think people who try to make identity more solid end up having a lot of problems. So, I mean, role-playing, you know, it's always still you. It's someone in there who's you. But to say you want to be a character in a story, that's not coming from you. That's coming from somebody else, and so it's like, no, I don't want to be that
person.
Well,
and it gets weirdly metaphysical, like to... Am I aware that I'm me being that person?
Well, and of course, someone could say, well, it's still coming from you because you're reading it and you're putting your spin and interpretation on, you know, you make up the voice you hear when you're reading it in the book. So technically, it's still a character in you.
And honestly, but, because I do believe in the importance of happiness and contentment in one's life, if we're going that route, I'm like, okay, what character had the happiest life? I want right. to be that one.
Yeah.
Because, as I said, when I was a young age, this was my most philosophical thing I said when I was a young age. I said, it's all about how you feel about your life. Because if you're somebody who became an architect and built a building, and you're super proud of that building, and it's just awesome, and you love it, and you love that you designed it, and mm-hmm. it was made, or you're a person who has a kid, and you love that kid, and you love the fact that that kid is made up of part you and part your spouse, and you raise that kid, and you're very proud of that kid, and what that kid has become, and you're like, I made that, you know? If on your deathbed, you feel the same, the guy who made the building feels the same about the building as the guy who made the kid, your lives have been pretty much equally of significance and equally happy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, to be fair, what the kid does later and who the building falls on is a whole other thing that I didn't get to when I was like 8 or 9. But the concept, and that's the thing, is whatever the hell I do in my life, at the end, I want to be happy that that's what I did with my life.
Yep, that's exactly how I feel.
I'm so much less concerned with what it actually is.
Well, I got more specific in saying I want to feel like it's all better. And I didn't even have to know what that meant exactly. And what better means has changed over time, which as it should.
But I do think that that's just an incident. You want to feel like it's all better because that's what would make you happy.
Yeah, right. Well, and hopefully other people too.
We got to wrap up here. Which is too bad because I wanted to tell the story about when the producer this week spontaneously, when talking about something with no particular context involved, referred to something as, that would be a mitzvah.
Well, what was it?
It was a hypothetical in which I would be doing a good deed. I mean, it was not an inaccurate statement.
Okay.
But that's not a word we just use.
Oh, okay.
not our common household Yiddish.
It's a perfectly serviceable word.
Absolutely. And effective for what she was going for, but it was really just out of nowhere. It was very weird. Cracked me up. Anyway, we're so over time, so we're going to end this, and that'll be a mitzvah. You know who doesn't do mitzvah?
Giraffes?
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.